The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back as we close out the last hour of the last day of the week here. It is a delight of the month. It is a delight to bring back our dear friend, cultural and presidential historian, Tevi Troy. Dr. Troy is author most recently of the book Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. It's great history. If you believe that you can get good history through biography, which I do, an autobiography, which I do, then this is a great, great history of not only the presidents from Truman to Trump, but the times. And it's fun. And there's a lot of great anecdotes, which Tevi is masterful at reproducing in a very readable book. Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. 25 years ago, pretty much to the day, Christopher Caldwell, who was then a senior writer, if not editor, at the Weekly Standard, which was once upon a time a conservative journal and once upon a time a journal, wrote a column.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's no longer conservative. It's just no longer.
It's just no longer a journal, yeah. Yeah, right. About 25 years ago, exactly to the day, Christopher Caldwell wrote a piece called Five Ways America Keeps Getting Better, and it was one of the most interesting pieces Tevi and I read independent of one another and both thoroughly found fascinating.
And continue to talk about.
And have been talking about ceaselessly for 25 years. I don't think there's a piece in any journal since the 90s that we have talked about as regularly as that piece.
I'm glad you added the caveat since the 90s.
Yeah, no, there are. I said it slowly.
Commentary pieces.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk about those. Pieces that have life. Pieces that stay alive. Chris Caldwell's, we thought for some reason 25 years ago, Five Ways America Keeps Getting Better had life. And Tevi himself, partly, I'd like to think, because we've been talking about it for 25 years, did, if you will, a sequel of sorts, called The Case for Optimism, which is in the Washington Examiner last week. And I wanted to cover both of them as we go into this weekend, especially given the times, which are quite similar if you think about it. So, Tevi, anyway, you've spoken, but I wanted to welcome you back appropriately. Hope that setup wasn't too...
Thanks for having me. I am officially welcome back. And I would look forward to speaking about both this piece and the precursor of the excellent Caldwell piece from 1996.
You know what's interesting, too? The way you open your piece, again, you wrote this about a week and a half ago, and yesterday on social media, this off moment B-roll audio and video of Clarence Thomas has been making the rounds. Have you seen it?
I have not.
Some TMZ reporters capture him leaving a restaurant. And he engages with them in the most light and touching and interesting and fun and humble and jocular of ways. It's just a real interesting sight to behold in a weird way, you know, because there's this mystery around the Supreme Court justices. And he's just the most regular guy you could find, and the reporters thoroughly enjoying him.
Yeah, I wouldn't claim to be close friends with him. Or even friends with him, but I have met him, and he is always so engaging,
right.
So entertaining,
right.
And so approachable.
Right. He will ask you about your family. Seriously, as you will see, he will ask these reporters about one of their siblings I couldn't hear. It was kind of interesting when he found out she was going to a school he was familiar with. Why that wind-up? The wind-up is there's something interesting about time and history. Tevi's piece opened a week and a half ago this way. Kind of something about the stumbling block will become the chief cornerstone, huh, Tevi? 30 years ago this summer, during the spectacle of the Clarence Thomas hearings, the late Judge Robert Bork said to the late Irving Kristol, "This is truly the end of Western civilization." Kristol, upon hearing Bork's assessment, agreed, but said, "Of course it is, but it'll take a long time. Meanwhile, it's still possible to live well." before we get to the meat and bones,
that the editors took out my phrase, Crystal took a long drag of his cigarette and said...
Did you?
Yes.
Well, that is such a better way to write the sentence. That is so much better. They took it out?
Yeah, well, you know, cigarettes are much more disfavored today than they were back then.
I know, but you can really get the scene. I mean, with the if Irving Kristol taking a moment, taking a drag of a cigarette and being all kind of smart and what would you say? Not exactly sardonic, a little sardonic and saying
a little one-upsmanship there, I'd say.
Yeah, a little bit.
Smart guys.
Yeah.
And knowing Bork, he probably took a drag of a cigarette too.
Thank you. And then they went and had a gimlet.
Right.
Okay.
True also.
All right. Yeah. Send this interview to the editors of the Washington Examiner, and it'll say the upbeat and the unvarnished, untrammeled, unedited, unreconstructed case for optimism. You write, these days conservatives once again have good reason to be down, and you list several. Similarly, Christopher Caldwell was pointing out that there were a lot of books at the time in 96 with titles like The End of Work, The End of Affluence, Silent Depression, Losers for Life, The No Hope Economy, documentaries. People were down too. And yet we tell ourselves, but hold on, we live in the greatest country the world has ever known. Are things as bad as the bookshelves and maybe parts of the culture want to tell us? And you and Caldwell squarely come down on they weren't then and they aren't now, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't say that we don't have problems today. Absolutely we have problems. But we also have some amazing capabilities, some great creature comforts that we didn't have before, and some possibilities for making things better on both the political and cultural fronts if we handle things right and if we express the ways that we got these creature comforts and these capabilities, and we can celebrate what America has to offer. I end the piece not only on a note of optimism, but on a recognition that optimism is a superior form of politicking, that the optimistic candidates are much more likely to win than the pessimistic candidates. And you can't be optimistic with the woke ideology, which is America is a terrible place, and it's systematically oppressive, and it's systemically racist. And if you say all those things, you cannot be optimistic about things, because the place you live is a terrible place, and it's unredeemable. And that is not the conservative approach. And the conservative ideas of we believe in standards, we believe in math, we believe in hard work, we believe in individualism, they have led to many of the beneficences we have today. And so the piece talks about some of the glorious things that we have today that we couldn't have imagined in the mid-90s when Chris Caldwell was writing. And he was writing in the mid-90s about things that were great then that you couldn't have imagined in a previous era. And sometimes I think we forget to take a step back, look around, and see what we have, as opposed to just saying, woe is me, everything's terrible, the woke is taking over, and we have no chance.
It might be worth pointing out, it's funny how advanced those things were in 1996 when Caldwell was writing. But we can come to that back to that later just to illustrate what advancement looks like. Because he did five things. You broke your piece into five categories: daily life, food, transportation, information, entertainment, medicine. We'll get to that in a moment. But you make a point that's somewhere in between something Dennis Prager has been saying for a long time and something I believed too, which is he will say there's a moral obligation to be happy because the happy make the world a better place and the unhappy make it a worse place. And I agree with that. And one of the interesting things about that is what you said, Tevi, which is you can't be woke and happy. And the woke are some of the most unhappy people there are, at least in public. And it's a funny thing because the woke is a progressive left situs, whereas you think of conservative, there is an image of the conservative as the old stodgy crank, like some kind of British parliamentarian from the 60s or something, right? And it's just not the case.
No. And also, I would say connected to what you're saying is about the moral obligation to be happy, there's also a moral obligation to be grateful.
Mm.
And gratitude is at the heart of conservatism. Gratitude for what came before us, gratitude for this great country, gratitude for Western civilization and how it brought the world out of barbarism, and gratitude for all that we have today that our ancestors didn't have. And if you're not grateful, you're unlikely to be conservative, and you're unlikely to be happy.
I want to come back on gratitude. That's a really interesting thing. In many respects, it's the opposite of pride, isn't it, which we have been warned about as well. Who knew we were going to get into the seven deadly sins here with Dr. Tevi Troy? We're not. We're going to be talking about the cause for optimism in America and his piece. Dr. Tevi Troy is cultural and presidential historian. His most recent book, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. We'll be right back. We are delighted to have with us this last hour heading into Memorial Day weekend, presidential and cultural historian Tevi Troy. Dr. Tevi Troy is the author of Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. You can follow and keep up with all his work at his website, TeviTroy.org, TeviTroy.org. Tevi, in my job, at least for 3 hours a day, I probably have more than the average American occasion to answer the question, how are you? You know, someone calls, hey, how's it going? How are you, Seth? That sort of thing. And I'm thinking I'm going to change my answer based on listening to you in the previous segment. I think I'm going to change my answer to something like, I'm great. I live in the greatest history. I live in the greatest country in the history of the world. Just great. Thanks. I think we should condition people to start thinking that way.
Maybe even the greatest moment in the greatest country in the history of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Even with all the challenges.
So there are, as you point out, a lot of things to be unhappy about. There always are. Progressive Democrats in charge of the presidency, as you write, as well as both houses of Congress. The pandemic aftershocks, the deficits. I mean, we can go on listing a parade of horribles that people who want to focus on that can't focus on. But there's a lot to be grateful about, which is related to optimism, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm getting at.
If you can go negative, you can go positive, I suppose, is the point. Go ahead.
There's this quote in there from Heather McDonald that I just love so much, that all these people on college campuses who whine about how oppressed they are, she said, they have at their fingertips what Faust sold his soul for, knowledge. All of human knowledge is available to us today. If you want to download all of Shakespeare or the Bible or Homer, it's there at your fingertips. You don't have this problem of the Irish monks trying to preserve civilization desperately by scrawling on pages in their monasteries like you had in the Dark Ages. You have everything is there and available for us. Now, are there modern-day woke centers? Sure. Are there problems? Sure. But we just have so much at our fingertips that we don't even think about. And that's what I really try about to talk about in this piece, in this Case for Optimism piece in the Examiner. And I try to show five ways in which these improve our daily lives in ways that are easily recognizable, and they manifest in our lives and in our existences and make things better. I mean, one thing I talk about is travel. I remember when I used to go on trips, let's say, to Los Angeles, which is a very difficult city to navigate. I would have to drive in a rental car with a map between my legs in my lap while driving through some shady areas, not really knowing where to go. And now with GPS, you can navigate any major city. It's not only major cities, but remote areas as well. I mean, it's a huge improvement. If you need to get somewhere, I mean, Uber has solved the problem of the taxi. And I make it very clear in this piece that I'm not saying that there aren't trade-offs and that I don't have some issues with the tech companies, but they've also provided a lot of great things that we get to take advantage of. And yes, Amazon and Facebook and Google are leftward-leaning and they're dominant today, but I don't know that they'll be dominant 20 years from now. These things change. And in fact, in Chris Caldwell's piece, when he talks about things that have improved stuff in the mid-90s. One of the things he highlights was Borders. Borders was great, and it gave people, you know, for those who don't remember, it was a bookstore. It gave people access to way more books, but it doesn't exist anymore. So these things change. If you look at the companies that did Super Bowl ads in 2000, many of them don't exist. And so there's a national business cycle where companies that seem dominant today may not be dominant tomorrow. But in the meantime, we've been given many great tools, many great capabilities, and we should appreciate them.
It's almost scary to think about the difference between in my life and your life now, between what it was in 1996 and what we were celebrating as, yeah, this is a pretty cool advancement when you step back and think about it, and saying those kinds of things. Not everything, of course, is improved. You put this in your essay as well. The way we entertain ourselves, perhaps we have more access, but not necessarily better quality. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I say firmly, I think Hollywood movies are worse today.
Yeah.
And I can say this with some knowledge and recent experience in that my son and I, whom you know, Seth, have been going through movies during the pandemic. We've seen over 100, and we're trying to watch great movies or classic movies. And, I hate saying they don't make them like they used to, but the truth is there was a style of movies in the 80s and 90s, of movies, and more 70s and 80s, maybe, of movies that were approachable, and that were good for the whole family, and that everybody could enjoy, and that has a larger message, and there was a universalism to them, and they focused on good writing. And now movies just seem either to be tent poles, right? The latest in the Star Wars saga, or the Fast and Furious saga, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe saga, or they're just woke expressions where they're trying to beat you down and tell you how terrible your existence in America is. So I think there are better movies. There were better Hollywood major studio offerings in the past. Those were better. However, I do say that what you can see on your small screen on your TV, and today you can make your small screen a pretty big screen, 50 inches, 70 inches are not uncommon. I think the variety of things you have through TV in some ways are better. We used to watch Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. I defy you to watch that show. Those shows today and compare them to comedies of today, which are just much faster, smarter, more sharply written. So, some things get worse and some things get better. But it's clear that we do have more options today than we have in the past.
I wonder if things get worse when they lose their mission. I was thinking of that in respect of Hollywood. And you're totally right. It's not just they don't make them like they used to. I do this on occasion. You're more of a film critic as well as aficionado than I am, so you likely could answer this question, but I can't, and I'll ask it. And I don't think most in my audience can answer it either. But what have been named two or three good, or even just two or three movies that have come out in the last 2 years? Anything memorable? And people will, go silent or start scratching their heads. Let me give you 1 year of Hollywood, 1963. Can I? I mean, this is just what you can pick. Do this with almost any year. But I like.
Yeah, I know what you're going to do, and it's going to blow your socks off.
It's going to blow. This is what Hollywood could do in 1 year.
Right.
Lawrence of Arabia, The Longest Day, The Music Man, Mutiny on the Bounty, To Kill a Mockingbird, Birdman of Alcatraz, Divorce Italian Style, Days of Wine, and Roses, The Miracle Worker, and Long Day's Journey into Night. I mean, this Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? I could go on. There are more. That's 1 year.
Or pick 1939 is one of my favorites.
Okay,
that year just blows you away in terms of the movies that were available in that 1 year with Cotton of the Wind and Wizard of Oz, and there's literally a dozen great movies that came in that 1 year, But if you look at the Oscar-nominated movies for this year, and as you correctly said, I am a film buff. I like to see a lot of movies. I haven't seen any of them, and I barely heard of most of them.
Exactly. Hold the line. Hold that thought real quick, Tevye. I want to do a quick 1939. I think you'd get Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Wuthering Heights, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, Of Mice and Men. Oh, my gosh. Love Affair. Be right back. Yeah, that's pretty good. Be right back with more from Tevye Troy. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. The case for optimism is a piece Tevi Troy wrote. We're talking about, there's a lot to be optimistic about. And whenever Tevi and I talk, we often like to challenge each other on the margins just a little bit, I guess, honing our steel, Tevi. So with that in mind, I just wanted to push a little on the Heather McDonald quote. You and I are huge fans of Heather. Fair to say we might even be. I'll say for myself, I'm a student of Heather's. I just think she's wonderful. And the quote you have of hers is instructive to a degree as far as I'm concerned. The quote is, any college student today at virtually any American college is among the most privileged human beings in history simply by virtue of having at his fingertips the thing which Faust sold his soul for, knowledge. Knowledge. And it's right, as far as it goes. But isn't there some kind of tension, Tevi, between knowledge and happiness, or wisdom and happiness, and what Heather's talking about? You and Heather are happy when you have access to knowledge. I don't know if everyone is. I don't know if that's what makes the progressive college student happy, that they have knowledge, even knowing that they have the ability to access knowledge. I think they are fundamentally unhappy in a way that knowledge will not fix, or access to it will not fix.
Look, I agree with you. I'm not going to push back on that one because you're right. There are people who don't appreciate what we have, and people who don't use the tools for good. I mean, we all know, and I'm not going to say it on this radio show, but we all know what the largest use of the internet is for. It's something that I don't do, and I don't.
Does it begin with a P? I don't know the answer to this. Does it begin with P?
It does.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that.
So a lot
okay.
of people use the internet for things that I don't think they should.
I didn't realize
for,
that. Okay. No. Okay. Yeah.
But that said,
we're talking about. We can say
that,
it. It's used for pornography.
Tool,
I talk about pornography here. It's okay. It's a word right. we can use. Go ahead.
But there are. But the fact that tools are used for ill
yeah.
does not mean we should ban the tool.
Right.
You know, look, we talk about this in the gun debate all the time. Yes,
right.
There are people who misuse guns, but there are a heck of a lot more people who use guns for appropriate purposes, for home protection and for hunting. And there's no reason to ban all guns because some people misuse them. We should perhaps say that there are certain people who shouldn't have access to
guns. You know,
guns.
We can ban money, too.
Or, you know, do you want to ban, you know, murders in European countries are more often to take place with knives.
Right.
You ban knives. I mean, you're trying to cut your steak with that one. So, yes, people misuse the tools. People don't appreciate the tools. But what I'm pointing out is that we have the ability to access the tools. And I don't think government can go out there and say, I think this is how you should think, or this is what this is how to pursue virtue. But I think society can give you the tools with which you can pursue knowledge and virtue. And I think we have more of those tools available to those who will avail themselves of it today than we have ever had before in history.
Totally agree. And at the same time, so let me reemphasize, totally agree. And at the same time, have more than a bit of concern, have more than a little concern about efforts at that manipulation, efforts at the manipulation of knowledge and history that comes with the free access. I suppose nothing's free, but the access we enjoy through these social media companies that have given us this. I almost feel as if a worm has turned, in a sense, Tevi. I almost feel as if we were encouraged to explore the wide, wonderful wonders of the World Wide Web, and then now having become, in a sense, addicted to it or reliant upon it, if you prefer, we are now subject to it kind of futilely, ideologically, in an odd, odd place that probably most of us didn't see coming.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I'm happy to critique the tech companies because there's a lot to critique. And I think that I don't like the woke leadership at the top of them and many corporations, let alone universities.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that we have to live and fall for them.
That's right.
And that doesn't mean we can't take advantage of what is out there. And that doesn't mean we can't fight for our vision of what is the appropriate culture. And I lay out in the article tools that we have that I think that the left doesn't have when making their case in terms of optimism and positivity and belief in individual virtue and belief in individual skills and meritocracy. And all these things help bring about the tools that I think lead to the advantages we have today. And I think you can't really lose a sense of that. And if you do lose a sense of it, I think that's a real problem.
That's really one of the most important parts of your piece here. The point about what has made America great, those who support the dynamism that you cheer on, or those who are fundamentally unhappy. I've got to take another commercial break, but if you'll let me pick up with you on that theme when we come back, I'd love to do that, Tevi. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Tevi Troy, author of several important books, bestsellers, the most recent, Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. We'll be right back. Those high utility bills and thinking about going solar, I want you to check out my friend Solar Sandy. Solar Sandy's different. The difference between Solar Sandy and the other solar companies is she's actually figured out how to truly zero out your power bill. It's so important when going solar you do it the right way, and Solar Sandy is the right way. She has the formula and wants to put more of your hard-earned money back in your pocket. If you sign up with Solar Sandy, she will pay your power bills for 1 year and your solar panel payments for 1 year, and you will receive a $1,000 bonus at signing. She's happy to do appointments in person or by Zoom, and I urge you to read the testimonials on her website. They're amazing. What's that website? AskSolarSandy.com. Go to AskSolarSandy.com to get started, or give her a call at 623-850-8229. That's 623-850-8229, or on the web at AskSolarSandy.com. We're talking to a historian and author, Tevi Troy, about cause for and reasons for the case for optimism in America. Tevi, this is super important, what you wrote in your essay here on let me just read you your words. On the woke left, attributes like capitalism, freedom, and individual drive are derided. On the woke left, these things are derided and affirmatively determined to be not worthy of celebration. Indeed, you're now seeing curriculum, as you point out, and the Smithsonian waded into this last year. A lot of these attributes are scheduled or toted up as being emblematic of white skin or white culture. It's very weird. But when the Smithsonian tried to identify what whiteness was, they identified things like self-reliance, objective, rational, linear thinking, and hard work as things that pertain only to the white race, or are clues to what the white race has. And if you have those things, to borrow from our president, you ain't black. And it was offensive in the extreme, to put it no higher. But those are the things that have made this country great, those and others, self-reliance, objective.
You're trying to design an iPhone without rational, linear thinking.
Yeah, right.
It's just not possible.
Right, right. Try and develop Apple without self-reliance and hard work.
Or a Tesla, or any
or anything.
Any great technological achievement. Or any great work of art.
Right, exactly. As you write, conservatives have a better case to make that recent improvements derive from traditional American dream inspired message, in stark contrast to what's coming out of Hollywood and universities these days. It's an interesting point when you think about what the left is trying to do. Are they involved in? Are they trying to resurrect some kind of notion of creative destruction, where they want to tear all these things down? Who thought we would come to a point in life where a museum promoting American greatness would say such things as self-reliance, linear thinking, hard work, and even religion are baleful attributes of our society?
I'll have to take issue with your bringing up creative destruction, which is Schumpeter's description of capitalism, which I think is apt, and I have no problem with creative destruction. This is destruction for its own sake. From the Alfred from the Batman movie, some people just want to see the world burn. I mean, if we want to tear down all the institutions, that's not creative destruction. That's destructive destruction. So I'm a fan of creative destruction. I have no problem with the fact that the top 20 companies in the Fortune 500 in 2000 are different than the ones that are at the top of the company in 2020 and will likely be different in 2040. I think that's also the good. So I'm for creative destruction that has something behind it that's trying to build something better. I'm against destructive destruction, which is tearing down the institutions that have made America a great place to live and that has helped America lead the world in developing these advantages that we now have today before us.
Erase everything I said in the lead up to the question and adopt what you said, the way you put it. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right for that correction or emendation. Destructive destruction. Obviously, that's what that's what a revolutionary temper is about, destroying, bringing down iconoclasm. But it is the very things that have made us great, and it makes us wonder, doesn't it, a little bit, what their vision of the future is. We've shown you ours. We've shown you what capitalism and generosity's vision paired with hard work can produce. It can produce everything we love about this country. I don't know what the other is. Doesn't seem to me that the Soviet Union produced anything any consumer ever wanted.
Nor the food needed to feed its populace, right?
Right.
I mean, beyond great inventions, it didn't produce the basics.
That's right. That's right. And on top of that, then we have to kind of assume, don't we, Tevi, that if we're going to go forward as conservatives and winning conservatives who believe in, whether you want to call it making America great again, keeping America great, but the greatness of America, the uniqueness and greatness of America, that can only come with a positive and optimistic temperament. I mean, that's the great lesson for conservatives, isn't it? Barry Goldwater can't really win with that temperament. Ronald Reagan can with that one.
Right, and also you can't invent new things if you're not fundamentally optimistic,
right.
If you don't fundamentally believe that you can create something that can make things better for those around you. Invention is a fundamentally optimistic action. And that's why you say traditionally so many business people were conservative. I know in recent days there's the problem of the woke corporation, but those people aren't usually the inventors.
No, and they may be presiding over the loss of their – I mean, they may be presiding over, negatives and downfalls in their corporations. I do think when a corporation has mission creep or loses its goal, that's when things do go south. And I think that's the story of some of those things that Christopher Caldwell was talking about, some of the things you were talking about. When we lose our purpose – as academics, as you and I could show in academia, when academia lost its purpose to study the important and true and actual things and got involved in, inventing new theories that make no sense, it made for worse education.
Right. And it's not just theories that make no sense. I mean, that's one way of putting it, but it's also theories that could not be understood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the great intellectuals of years past, they wrote for a widely educated audience.
That's a good point.
Whereas the academics of today write for the narrowest possible audience, and they write in intentionally obfuscatory language so that not only common people, but well-educated people who are not of that field will not understand it.
And they're not happy when they do it.
Right, that's true.
Tevi Troy, have a meaningful Memorial Day. Thanks for spending some of your Friday afternoon with us.
Thank you, Seth, for inspiring me to write this piece.
You betcha. When we come back, as I do now, I think is my second year in a row. Maybe this will be our annual Memorial Day thing. When we come back, I got a little, I hope it's a treat for you. I hope you consider it a treat. Don't go away. We'll be right back. The TAPS bugle call has long, at least since the 1860s, has long been the call of the bugler or the trumpet when the soldier goes to rest or his final rest. Anyone who's been to a U.S. military funeral knows the importance of it, as anyone who lives in this country should know the importance of the service of those who it is played for and whose memory we will commemorate this weekend and this Monday. In my effort to salute you as well. Here I shall play for you my version on my trumpet of Taps.